homogeneous pattern. But if you get one pattern down, then you can start seeing all the exceptions. So we'll look in terms of how the process occurs, and then we'll look at the impact on a person's life in terms of when a person's been abused. Then, once we've looked at the impact, we'll look more internally at the damage done as a result of abuse. And then hopefully with the time left, look at the response of a person who's been damaged internally, how they handle the internal realities in a way that in fact creates an even greater abusive event than the one they originally experienced. What must be heard from the very beginning is that the abused person, generally speaking, continues to abuse themselves in ways that are as awful as the original abuse itself. And, sad but very true to say, the abused individual often abuses literally and metaphorically others in the way that they've been abused as well. And therefore, we want to get to the response to see how shame and contempt works itself out. Hopefully, that's a broad and clear overview of the material that we'll be covering. First of all, introduction. A few very quick points. First of all, many of you have not been sexually abused. And yet you'll find the material, I would hope, fitting you as well. And the reason I hope you see it fitting you is that many of you have been abused, but not sexually. Many of you have been physically abused. Many of you have been emotionally abused. And much of the material I'm about to cover will fit you as much as, in many cases, the individual who's been sexually abused. I think there's something generic to abuse in terms of its damage to your soul. I think there's some specific issues that relate to sexual abuse, and that will be our broad focus. I'm not going to be dealing with emotional abuse. I'm not going to be dealing with physical abuse. But you will see overlap, even if you've never been abused. As well, I don't know if I've ever taught this material in an audience such as this, even an audience of very bright, aware, theoretically in many cases astute individuals, where it didn't occur that someone realized in the midst of the lecture or a day later that they in fact had been abused and they had not faced it before. That's one of the reasons it's very difficult material to give, because I know that there are individuals here who've been abused sexually. And there's no way in the world, even if you're already a point of just major change, if you want to use the word major healing, every time you put your finger back in the wound, it hurts. And it brings forth all sorts of new areas to be looked at, all sorts of new struggles to be faced, as well as a whole lot to be thankful for in terms of the work God's already done in your life. In other words, even if it be joy or whether it be sorrow, there will be tumult within you as you hear the material. There's just no other way for it to be presented than for it to create at some level some pain in your soul. As well, those who have not faced that they've been abused, it makes it that much more difficult because you'll be sitting here taking notes and trying to listen to concepts, but you'll have memories flooding your mind. You have certain situations occurring to you that make it very hard to listen. And my thought is, do really whatever you desire. If it's to leave, leave. If it's to take notes furiously, take them furiously. If it's to take no notes at all and just sort of sit and listen and get the tape later, do whatever you desire to do. God is going to work in you. That's an assurance. His timing and his way might be very different than you so desire. But your part is simply to participate in whatever way you so desire. Therefore, I hope you feel no pressure to sit here and hurt. Go ahead and write furiously. If you want to hurt, feel free to do so and don't take any notes at all. Feel very free to do as you desire as you hear this material. I also want you to hear, as you know only too well if you've done any reading and any thinking on this particular topic, it is a pervasive issue. It is a pervasive issue in our culture. There is no home in your community that is immune to the issues of abuse, in particular sexual abuse. There's no church, there's no socioeconomic class, there's no professional class or professional person. This is an issue that is pervasive as people. And therefore, you just can't be surprised by the high incidence of it or by where it occurs. And if it's pervasive, I'd say we're going to find this to be a persistent social issue. I think we can only assume that the issue will be worse in 5 years than it is now. And by the time our children are our ages, I would guess, just my broad guess at this point, that what they have found in research studies is that 38% of most women in the U.S. have been abused by the age of 18. My bet is by 5, 10, 15 years down the road, if it's not 1 out of 2, if it's not close to maybe 60, 70% of all women who've been abused, I'd be very, very surprised. So it's not an issue that's going to go away. We're not talking about a hot item, which kind of got national media attention and is going to die down. These are issues that you need to understand from my standpoint. You are only putting in the smallest amount of time to hear what these issues are. If you in any way, shape, or form think that the material over the next hour, hour and a half will be sufficient for you to work with abused people, I want to dissuade you of that immediately. This is a significant issue. I encourage you to do reading on it, thinking on it, attending seminars on it, talking with individuals who've been abused. You know people who've been abused, I promise you. If you know more than 4 women, you know someone who's been abused. My bet is if you know more than 3 women, you know someone who's been abused. If there are 100 women in this audience, over 38 to 40 of you have been abused. In terms of men, the figure shows somewhere between 8 and 12%. I think it's ridiculously underreported. I think we'll find in 10 years that the incidence of male sexual abuse, in terms of male as victim, will be very, very, very close to what in fact it is with females. Maybe never quite as high, but awfully close. My bet is it's somewhere in the 20, 25% range at this point in time. But can't verify that. It's just from my own clinical experience and my own guesswork that the incidence is extremely high. At the point it's 8 to 12% reported, my bet is it's at least double. So we're talking about a persistent problem that's going to last generationally. As we see ourselves coming closer and closer to the end of the age, I think we're going to see the problem get more significant and far worse. As well, I want to add the last P here. It's a pernicious problem. Pernicious in the sense that the results often don't show themselves for decades, but they're there. Very, very seldom. Perhaps hypothetically, I'll argue it's possible that a person can be abused at age 4 and never have any effects. Possible to be abused at age 12 with very minor effects. It's possible. Theoretically, anything's possible. But in fact, what I'd like to argue is no one escapes the damage of having been abused. Time is no healer. All it does is distance you. Simply having the work of knowing God, knowing the scriptures, loving the Lord and loving others is the context for change, but in many cases doesn't deal with the underlying structure that often comes as a result of abuse. And therefore, in most cases, an individual who's been abused is going to need a community that understands the problem. Far more in some sense than a therapist. Though in times, I do think that people do need individual work. Far more, you don't understand the incredible impact the community of God can have in the lives of abused people if they just have 2 or 3 people who understand what they've gone through and are able to, in one sense, shepherd them through the process of change. Almost more than having a therapist, I'd argue we need a community. And in one sense, one of our basic pieces of work from the lecture that I'm hoping to give you is to educate you sufficiently that you're not likely to do the obvious kinds of damage to people who've been abused. Well, that's my introduction. Let me begin talking about the process of abuse. First of all, let me tell you what sexual abuse is. And then I want to talk about the process by which it occurs. Sexual abuse is whenever any adult has an interaction, and that's a very important word, an interaction or contact with a child for the purposes of that adult's sexual pleasure. The reason I underline the word contact and interaction, don't be naive to think of abuse as involving only intercourse or obvious kinds of physical sexual touch. That's obvious and needs to be added, but I also want to underline another part of sexual abuse, and that is the word interaction. A father who, in quotation marks, inadvertently walks in on his teenage daughter as she's showering quite often. Is that abusive? The answer is, of course. Was there any physical touch at all? There may not have been. And therefore, what you need to hear is, that may not fit what might be called scientific or legal definitions of the term sexual abuse. A father who walks in on his teenage daughter four or five times when she's 14 years of age and is clearly ogling her and enjoying her body for his own purposes, could he be prosecuted in most states for sexual abuse? Answer is, likely no. So it doesn't fit the legal definition in most cases of sexual abuse, but is it sexual abuse? How about the brother who's 5 years older, who entices the younger sister into looking and peering and participating in pornographic pictures, or just in perviewing pornographic magazines? Is that sexually abusive? The answer is, of course. Some of the same damage that will be done when a young woman is raped by a father will be there at some form when that young woman is invited to look at pornographic magazines by her 4 or 5 year old brother. And that's very hard for people to comprehend. Because what we assume is something very, very simple and accurate but inaccurate. And that is, abuse has a certain level of severity. And when it's high, it has damage. When it's low, it probably doesn't have much consequence at all. What I want to say is, yes, a young woman, a 14-year-old woman who's raped by her father or uncle is going to have, in most cases, far more significant struggles than when, as an 8-year-old girl, or her 12-year-old brother had her touch his penis. Will there be differentiations in terms of the severity level? The answer is yes, of course. It just makes common sense and it's true. On the other hand, what I want to say, and this is the metaphor I've used before, If you have two vehicles moving at 50 miles an hour and they both hit you, what will the damage be? If one happens to be a Mack truck and the other happens to be a tricycle, is there a difference between a Mack truck and a tricycle or a bicycle? Of course. Will the damage be different? Of course. But the bottom line is, in both cases, you'll die, or likely you'll die. And so you must hear, at least in the metaphor, you'll die, is that the damage is deep, irrespective of the nature of the abuse. Don't be what I want to call a minimalizationalist, somebody who minimizes the damage simply because the severity didn't seem that bad. Be very aware when you work with abused people, there's an attitude of, I may have been raped, but it was only 5 times. But I know somebody who was raped 100 times. And I have known people who were literally tortured by their fathers. Tied to beds and despicable, horrible, awful, almost satanic, heinous harm done to them. And they've still said, but I know somebody who had it worse. And as long as you have the notion that, yeah, mine was bad, but someone else's was worse, what you tend to do is you minimize the damage to your own soul. And as well, there's a strong proclivity to, in fact, see what you went through as non-abusive. I had a woman once describe to me a process by which she was taken to a nudist colony from age 6 to age 17. Every summer for 3 months, she was required by her parents to be unclothed for the entire summer. During a 1 week period of time, the clothed community was invited to take pictures at a beauty pageant. All the young women were required to be part of it. So for years and years and years, 1 week of the year, she was required to stand or pose in any particular pose that any particular photographer desired, which clearly in most cases was pornographic poses. Just the process of being naked in front of other human beings in and of itself is abusive, let alone the use of photographs for pornographic pictures. She asked me the question with utter sincerity as she told me the data. I know that I wasn't abused, but I still have that question in the back of my mind. Can you tell me with the data that I've given you, was I sexually abused? And the answer, of course, is without a shadow of a doubt. And yet, it was as hard to convince her of that as could be imagined, because there was no physical contact. Understand, contact or interaction implies abuse. As well, add one more point to the definition, and that is, when I say an adult, it can equally be a child with either one of two categories. who equally abuses another child, a child either with significant age difference, usually we talk about 2 to 3 year age difference, as being an abusive relationship. Or even if it's a peer relationship, but the other party, the abuser, has significant authority or power in the family. A brother who's only 9 months or a year older who abuses you, if he has significant power in the family, he could make it hard for you to live in that family if you did not participate in the abuse. In fact, constitutes an abusive event. Somehow to call childish, peerish, brother-sister exploration as just kind of normal sexual contact. Normal, if you define as the word average or common, yes. Normal defined as non-damaging? Oh no, don't go the minimal route. That's not a fair route to go in terms of the damage done to the human soul. What's the process in which abuse occurs? As I mentioned before, I want to say again, I think it's very important for you to hear that there's no one homogeneous route by which abuse occurs. And the only reason I talk about this one process is to let you know the context for where the harm is done. 4 major stages in most abusive events. Stage 1 is the stage of the development of closeness and secrecy. The development of closeness and secrecy. This is the stage where there's no sexually abusive contact, but there's the development of intimacy between the abuser and the abusee. One woman described for me a time in which for about 8 weeks in a row, she was invited by her father to go fishing. Though she had 3 other male siblings, they never got invited. And it was a great privilege to be able to go fishing with dad. 8 weeks of contact where she was the special one who was invited to go out. In that time, he said to her at one point, "Let's go for ice cream, but don't tell anyone else in the family. Because if we tell, we'll have to take them too." And so there was a development of kind of a bonding between the two of them. One woman I know had a teacher who literally used to write her notes for 2 years and to share with her details about his life and to give her the access to a level of intimacy between basically teacher and student that is not available in most normal and right student-teacher relationships. Stage 1 is the period of connection. Stage 1 is the period of connection. And now underline a major point. Most individuals who are abused, and here I want to suggest, as Larry said the other night, who in this room hasn't been abused? If we make the differentiation between capital A abuse, which is what I'm talking about today, and small a abuse, in other words, have you ever been sinned against? Has anyone ever sinned against you? Then you've been damaged. And if you've been damaged, you've been abused. You have been used. You have been harmed. As another quick aside, if you've been in a relationship with even a man who used you sexually, many of these concepts will parallel even if you were an adult. To be a 26-year-old woman in relationship with a 28-year-old man, where in fact, in order to keep the relationship, there were certain sexual favors which you had to extend or you felt like you had to extend in order to keep that relationship bonded. Chances are you're going to find many of these concepts parallel to your experience as well. So when I talk about the fact you've got a damaged soul, there's a certain hunger in the human soul that longs for bonded contact, a certain level of intimacy, a certain hunger that's there ever prior to the abuse. And that's the incredible damage that you'll later see in terms of shame and contempt. The damage done to the human soul is that I hunger for relationship and the abuser offers it. I hunger for relationship and the abuser seems to be putting out before me meat that will satisfy my hunger and drink that will slake my thirst. They're providing me with a taste of life. Going fishing with dad 8 weeks in a row, that feels like life because it is, for that 12-year-old or 8-year-old, a taste of what life was meant to be. And therefore, generally speaking, in stage 1, there's a sense of connection, there's a sense of intimacy, and a sense of life that develops. Stage 2. is the stage of what I will call appearingly appropriate physical intimacy. The stage of appearingly appropriate physical intimacy. If you were to observe the physical contact in stage two, it wouldn't immediately, in most cases, alert you to anything other than a good, normal, healthy relationship. The uncle who scratches his nephew's head when he comes in the house. Does that look like sexual abuse? Of course not. The grandfather who gives a hug to the granddaughter. And maybe it lingers just a little longer than maybe what you'd feel comfortable with. But it's clearly not abusive. Stage two, the abuser generally begins to anesthetize the senses of the victim by offering them a chance to taste not just relational intimacy, but physical intimacy. The hug, the kiss, the pat on the back, the scratch of the head. One woman described a process by which her uncle said to her, "Would you like to learn, as a 13-year-old girl, would you like to learn how to drive a car?" Now, what 13-year-old girl in her right mind would say, no? I mean, the idea of any 13-year-old, that's just a fantasy from about age 8 on, is to get your own car, at least in most middle-class American homes. And she delighted at the thought that she was going to get the chance to learn how to drive a car. So stage one, he invited her to do something special and unique. And then he went on to say, we're going to be going down roads and going places that I'm not sure your dad would want me to go, because it might be kind of dangerous driving. So make sure you tell no one. Stage two, in order to learn to drive, what he did was he had her sit very close to him and to keep her hand on the steering wheel. It progressed from the point where she was sitting on his side or near his side to where she was finally sitting on his lap. And then it went from him having her sit on his lap to where he'd occasionally move his hands to the wheel and brush by her thighs. And this went on for a period of weeks before the first physical, clearly sexual contact occurred. During that period of time, she felt a certain level of uncomfortability. But again, what 12-year-old has the categories of an adult that's able to say, this is inappropriate? That's a physical contact or touch that is utterly inappropriate on that man's part to be touching me in that way. Again, you cannot comprehend the fact that a child or even an adolescent doesn't think in adult forms. And so that child is not sitting there thinking about the fact that this adult is moving into her life in a way that seems inappropriate. She might at best know that it feels awkward or uncomfortable, but is not likely to put sexual categories to her own awkwardness. And therefore, lots of behavior can continue that in fact would make a very adult woman very uncomfortable and clearly be aware that this man was seducing her or soliciting contact of a sexual nature. Again, as a woman, do you not know when a man is checking you out in a clearly sexual form? The answer is, in most cases, you do. Or when a hug has something more to it than just a matter of a brother-sister hug. Chances are, you may not be shooting at 100%, but in most cases, you do have a sense of it. But are you going to say that a child does? Are you going to say that even an adolescent does? That's just wrong to impute to the eyes and the mind of a child or an adolescent forms of comprehension which are often not even there for adults. But if it is, it comes only after years of maturation. And so in stage two, there's a sense in which that child is tightened in the net of that abuser's clutch. Stage three is the stage of what we'll call sexual abuse proper, meaning actual sexual abuse, where the adult moves from what appears to be appropriate physical touch to clearly immoral, inappropriate, sinful sexual contact. Stage four is the stage that we'll call the stage of threats and maintenance of the sexualized relationship. Threats and maintenance of the sexualized relationship. This is the stage where either one of two things occur. Either one, the abuser secures the confidentiality of the victim by threatening physically or psychological harm. If you tell your mother, I'll kill you. If you tell your father, your mother will have a nervous breakdown and you'll never have a mother again. Clear physical or psychological threats. And that may be simply to keep the act of abuse private. Or, as in many cases, it's to keep not only the act private, but also to keep available the continued opportunity for abuse. If you tell, or if you won't let me do this again, then you fill in the blank in terms of the damage that I'll do to you or to others. In which case, many children, even as old as sometimes 17, 18, 19 years of age, feel compelled to keep quiet or feel compelled to continue in what they know to be, at best, a very, very inappropriate or awkward relationship. And at worst, just know that somehow it doesn't feel good or right in the way that they longed for internally in terms of the original stage one contact of the development of intimacy and contact. Those are the four major stages. Now, what I want to do is to shift focus very quickly and to say, what is the impact of that kind of process in the mind and the heart of a child or adolescent? Follow the stages. Now, I'm just going to talk about it from the developmental standpoint. At first, what there will be is the development of hunger. Stage one, there'll be the development of hunger. And that is that particular child or adolescent will experience a certain form of nourishment that's satisfied. A certain form of nourishment that satisfies, but only creates a hunger for more. Generally speaking, most who come from abusive environments come from environments that do not know how to love well at all. Otherwise, why would the abuse have occurred later at all? And so that environment that's in fact a very empty, a very nourishment-less environment is an environment that absolutely provides no opportunity for thriving life. So that in stage one, that child finds some satisfaction and then even greater hunger. And that moves into what we'll call the second aspect, and that is the development not just of hunger, but the development of dependence. When you're starving, what are you going to do? Are you not going to move toward the one who has food? If you're dying of thirst, are you not going to, in one sense, become compulsively drawn to the one who can offer you the opportunity to satisfy your thirst? The metaphor here that I think best fits is the metaphor from C.S. Lewis's Narnia series. You recall that in the first book, Edmund went into the Frozen Land and was captured by the White Witch. By what means? A substance called Turkish Delight. What did Turkish Delight do? Did it poison him? Did it kill him? The answer is no. There was nothing wrong with it. In and of itself, it simply enticed and created a hunger for more. And therefore, the only one who had more was the White Witch, and therefore he became entrapped. That's what I mean by this next aspect, is the development of dependence. The one who can touch me most deeply, I'll find myself drawn to compulsively. And whether that be in terms of financial support, obviously a 14-year-old girl who's being abused by her father knows that the only alternative is the street. And that's why, by the way, most children who run away, I don't want to say all, but most children who run away have a history of abuse. Most of the street prostitutes, research that's been done in San Francisco, most of the street prostitutes between the ages of 12 and 18, almost to the point of 100%, have had abusive sexual pasts. Many, many who work in teen ministries like Teen Challenge describe that many of the individuals who are part of their ministry, some of the group involved in Teen Challenge in Nashville told me that about 94-95% of all the women that they work with have been abused sexually. So in terms of severe drug abuse, in terms of runaways, most of that has some sexual abuse tied to it. And so dependency develops, which either you flee from or become entwined in. And so it's very difficult to break out of. You have hunger, then you have dependence. Third, you have the development of intimacy. The development of intimacy. And let me see if I can put this on the overhead in a way that will hopefully make some sense. What you have in the context of the development of intimacy, better not do that. Is that because there is a form of intimacy, and tied to intimacy is always the word pleasure. Whenever you're intimate with another human being, you will experience some form of pleasure. If you want another word for it, some form of enjoyment. Can you experience a connectedness with another human being without a sense of somehow feeling warm inside, feeling alive inside, feeling passionate inside? Intimacy produces certain kinds of internal effect, warmth, life, passion. And that's what goes on in stage one and stage two. You have that sense of connection that develops a certain level of pleasure. Certainly at first, stage one, what do you have? You have relational intimacy and pleasure. But often, as it begins to develop in stage two, what do you then have? If I come up to you and afterwards give you a back rub, I put my hands on your neck and I massage your neck so that you feel some level of the tension pouring out of your body. Or if I come up and scratch your head and you're not too afraid of human touch, what are you going to experience when I do that? Aren't you going to experience sensual pleasure? In other words, is there any possibility of being touched, literally physically touched, without something happening that's sensual? The problem is, immediately in your minds, you've done what most Americans and what most 20th century individuals do, and that is you connect sexual with sensual. Is every back rub you've ever received from someone sexual? Of course not. But can a back rub be given that is not sensual? Well, no, it's impossible. You've defied, I almost said the word gravity, but that's not the word. You've defied the way God has built us if you don't feel certain level of sensual pleasure. And so, stage one, there's certainly going to be relational pleasure. Stage two, there's going to be sensual pleasure in terms of the physical contact. If you know where I'm going, you know where I'm going. And that is in stage three. In many cases, I don't want to argue all, but in many cases, as long as the abuse is not severely violent, but I also want to put a parenthesis here, I've worked with individuals who've been gang raped. And in the middle of being gang raped, had the most horrendous experience that often was the cause of untold shame for them, and that is they experienced sexual pleasure. So the dilemma is, in many cases, even when there is severe, strong, awful, heinous, physical violence, often there's, again, sexual pleasure. But in times when there's not violence, when it has been done, if you will, and it's such an awful word to use with this, if the abuse has been done tenderly, then in fact, what is the person going to experience? It's going to experience sexual pleasure. And what I mean by sexual is just simply this. There are sensations that even a 3 or 4 year old can experience that are clearly different than, for example, having their back scratched. A young female child can experience something akin to an orgasm. A young male child may not be able to have an ejaculation, but can experience strong sexual pleasure in having his penis touched, even as young as a few months of age. So the fact is, God has built our sexual parts with more nerve endings than any other part of our body other than our taste buds. And at a young age, those are present in such a way that they can be activated. And therefore, in many, many cases, the individual who's been abused has felt absolutely cataclysmic, heinous sexual pleasure that they despise and enjoy at the same time. What occurs is, as long as the relationship is good, that feels good. As long as sensual pleasure is there, that feels good. And for a time, in many cases, there's a certain level of sexual pleasure that may feel uncomfortable or awkward or inappropriate, but because, hear this phrase, because it's tied to the even deeper pleasure of relationship, it can be justified for a period of time. It can be put in context for a period of time where the individual at some level feels afraid plus also reluctant to give it up. And that's where you move then into the fourth part, and that's the development of discomfort. The development of discomfort, where they move from a sense of intimacy and pleasure to what is in fact true, and that is that they're being used. Is that four-year-old child aware she's being used? Not in adult or even adolescent categories, but I want to say almost organically or ontologically, there's going to be some teeniest sense that she's being violated. Somehow this is not right. She's being used in a way that doesn't enhance her sense of life. Certainly that would be true for an older child or adolescent. Will be a sense of being used. What comes with a sense of being used? Well, a sense of feeling empty, feeling alone, feeling abandoned, feeling angry to the point of feeling enraged and hateful. Are those pleasant feelings to have? Understand the precarious position that the abused child is in. If I own my hatred, if I own my emptiness, if I own the sense of being used, what might I lose? The only taste of pleasure, relationally, sensually, and perhaps sexually, I've ever enjoyed in my life. You take away my chance for life. And what do I have if I give up the abuse? As one woman said to me, I knew that if I put a stop to the abuse, I would have no relationship with him at all. And he was the only one who provided me with a taste of life. Is it better to give up life than to stop being used? That's a terrible dilemma that the abused woman or man finds himself in. And that's where I have the final stage, the development of strong confusion, the development of craziness, the development of strong ambivalence. In other words, the final particular stage is I feel torn into shreds. I feel confused. I feel crazy. Because I'm feeling used, but I'm not cutting off the pleasure. And so you have two radically opposite internal experiences coexisting at the same time, which brings you both a sense of relief and craziness at the same time. And that's why, generally speaking, the basic strategy of those who've been abused is to kill their soul by not even being conscious of the past abuse. That is why it is not unheard of at all. It's as common as common can be that a person who's been abused, even at age 14, 15, will not even recall the abuse until sometimes their 30s, 40s, or 50s. And we're not talking about kind of like, I don't want to think about it, so I put it out. It's almost as if it's an amnesic fugue. I'm not aware of it at all. And I watch a TV show, or I have a conversation, or listen to a lecture, and all of a sudden, like a jackhammer, some memory pushes its way through, and you have that sense of, I'm crazy. I'm remembering something that couldn't have occurred. There's no way in the world this occurred. My father would never have done something like that to me. And so if it's not amnesic, then it's almost dissociative in terms of sections of my soul are not just deadened, they are cut away. Cut away and locked in a sort of Pandora's box that nobody has a key to and no one's ever going to open up. The result of that, all sorts of consequences. But you can see that there's a deep, deep conflict in the soul of the woman or the man who's been abused. What's the damage that's done? Third major point, what is the damage that's done from that kind of impact? The damage that's done can be put in three broad categories. Again, I want you to hear I'm not doing justice to the concepts. I'm giving you just a little thumbnail sketch. You need to go to other seminars, participate in reading and other materials for you to get a broader view. So that's my apology. Three broad categories in terms of the internal damage done. Category one is the person who's been abused is going to feel powerless. Let me deal with that first, and then we'll talk about the second and third. Powerless. Generally speaking, it can be said that the individual who's been abused has been unable to change their family ever. And many times the abused individual is the child, often selected because of certain adult-type capacities, is often the child who's the most competent, the most verbal, the most attractive, the most capable, and is put in a position of power in their home. And so they have the experience in their homes prior to the abuse of being what I've called powerlessly powerful. They're powerful in that they're given the rights to go shopping. I had one 15-year-old boy who, when he was 15, he was a 36-year-old man, but when he was 15, he was required to do all the work on all the cars in the family. And often he had to drive a car that he didn't have a license for to a particular gas station to get advice as to how to fix other parts on the other car. So he was a very powerful family member. I had another woman who literally, about age 10, started doing the checkbook for her mother and handled most of the finances, groceries, cooking, etc. Powerful, but powerless, because with all her power, she was unable to change the warp and the direction of the family. It was an empty home she could do nothing about. Not only that, but obviously powerless in terms of unable to control the abuse itself. The power differential is so great between a father, uncle, older brother, cousin, father-in-law, brother-in-law, and even an 18, 19-year-old girl. The power differential is so great, an adult to a child, an adult to an adolescent, that in fact that adult can get away with near murder. And somehow, culturally and often familially, it's viewed as the child's fault. And so the child can't stop the abuse. And perhaps just as painful, the child can't stop the pain and the woundedness in their own heart. Do you hear the powerlessness I'm talking about? I can't change my family. I can't change the abuse. I can't change the turmoil in my own soul. And what does that do? What's the consequence of all that? Well, follow this. If in fact there's something terribly wrong with me, that I can't change my family, with all the good grades I'm getting, I can't make my family happy. With all my effort to make it to the basketball team and make it on the first team, and I do and I score well, it doesn't seem to change at all the structure of the emptiness and unhappiness in my home. I can't change my world. What happens is the creation of what I want to call deep doubt. Deep personal doubt. Deep, deep doubt about yourself. What's wrong with you? Why didn't you do it better? Do you hear now the word contempt? Because doubt leads to constant reflection as to what's wrong with you. Why didn't you do that better? Why didn't you get a better grade? Why shouldn't you? You should have been aware of what he wanted from you. Deep doubt leads eventually to despair. Despair in terms of why bother? Why bother? Who cares? Some theoreticians and authors have talked about it as learned helplessness. The sense of, as I felt with Algebra 1, I took it one time, as I've told you probably before, and failed it. And I got tutoring. I really wanted to do well in math, and I didn't do well. Second year through, I tried it again, got all sorts of tutoring and help. 3 weeks into the term, when I'd gotten a 0, a 5, and a 10 on three tests, all of 100 points each. Point is, why bother? Are you kidding? Why expend effort and energy in a direction you know you're going to fail no matter what you do? That's learned helplessness, or another word for that is despair. What does despair lead to? Deadness. Deadness. What Larry talked about last night. A deadness of the soul. I no longer want to hurt, therefore I anesthetize myself. Are you with me so far? Is that making sense? Now let me go on. What does deadness lead to? I'll explain it in a moment, but just follow it. It leads to impaired judgments. Pain is the basis of good judgment. And if somehow I've deadened myself to pain, I'm likely to make ongoingly sinful, but nevertheless destructive choices because I won't have developed a sense of wisdom. The parallel course is Paul Brand's book and Philip Yancey's book, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, where they describe the impact of leprosy. As a metaphor, I'm describing the soul, but they describe the physical body, and I think it's a good parallel in terms of the fact that leprosy doesn't destroy in and of itself. What it does is it destroys nerve endings. As a result of destroying nerve endings, people are able to put their hands in fire or cut themselves, and they never feel it. And therefore, they make bad judgments as to what's hot, what's cold, and they harm themselves. That's true with the abused individual who has been powerless because they doubt, they despair, they deaden, they lose pain. When you're dead, do you feel pain? I have a very good friend who's a child psychologist, one of the more gifted women I know in terms of working with people, especially children. Very gifted woman. She was abused extensively, severely, grotesquely abused over a lengthy period of time. There were times when her father would tie her to a bed and drop acid between her legs. And then would rape her, because he liked to hear her scream when he raped her. And she didn't scream loud enough, simply from the physical sexual abuse. So this woman has had untold pain. But in her way of coping with it, she's deadened herself very deeply. How? She has no sense of physical awareness of her body. One day, on the way to work, she noticed that her silk blouse had a wrinkle in it. So she took out an iron and ironed the wrinkle out. Later that day, she pulled her blouse back, her sleeve. Well, physical pain with immunity. And if you can handle physical pain with immunity, it's likely you handle soulish pain with immunity as well. And therefore, you can put yourself back into continually abusive events that continually do you harm. The rate of revictimization is almost double for those who have gone through sexual abuse as a child compared to, if you will, a regular population who has not been abused. In other words, if you've been abused, you're likely almost double, likely double the recipient, the victim of later lifetime sexual abuse or victimization. Why? It's hard to describe. I'm not trying to pin it down entirely on this. But I would like to say that many times women or men who've been abused often put themselves back into abusive relationships, often are willing to endure harm to their souls and to view it as normal, no big deal. Many, many times the abused woman will find a man who will continually abuse her because, again, in broad categories, it's what doesn't require of her a shift in her patterns of shame and contempt because he confirms what she frighteningly already believes about her own soul. That's powerlessness. Let me talk about betrayal. Second category in terms of the damage done is the category of betrayal. Betrayal comes, obviously, as a result of what? First, it comes by the family of origin prior to the abuse at all. Ever prior to the abuse, the family has failed that child by not providing the child with nurture, with love, with support, with involvement, with respect, with kindness, with tenderness. In other words, that child has been abused by being sinned against just in that typical home that is distant, often rigid, often authoritarian, often uninvolved, relationally bereft in all sorts of ways. And by the way, if you heard the categories I just spewed out, what you know is I just described many typical fundamentalist and evangelical homes. Rigid, rule-bound, authoritarian, distant, demanding, secretive, loyal, many, many Christian homes pridefully fit under that particular flag. And in that home, that child's been abused because that child's empty and hasn't been touched in the way that they were meant to be held and cared for. But add to that, obviously, not just that betrayal, but the second level of betrayal, and that's the betrayal that occurs through sexual abuse proper. That child has been set up and then harmed. A metaphor, but describes it very well. One woman told me about the abuse that she went through with her father. And she described it this way. It's as if, just metaphor now, it didn't literally happen this way, but metaphor. She said, it's as if I had been left in my home for 13 years, only allowed to have about 2 or 3 glasses of water a week. I was constantly thirsty, never ever having the thirst utterly quenched. And then one day, my father offered me a cold, cool glass of some liquid. And because of my thirst, I grabbed it as if it were life itself, and I poured it down my throat. I didn't even taste it. It felt so cool, so cold, so cleansing, so alive, that I didn't taste it until I finally drunk it to its very dregs. Only then did I realize that what I had poured into my system was literally urine. Was a poison, was something that is heinous, something so awful as urine. And that's the damage of betrayal, is that the abused person has a taste of life in the context of having their soul degraded. And that's so confusing. So confusing as to how I can feel nourished when I'm being degraded. How I can feel cared for when I'm being used. How I can feel alive when I'm being put to death. That's a confusion. That's a craziness of the soul that's very hard to comprehend. And if that's not enough, there's more betrayal. And that's often the betrayal of the non-offending or non-participant abuser. Many cases, that will be the mother. Many times, it will also be both parents. I've worked with many individuals who have been as severely abused by the non-offending participant as the participant, the abuser himself. Let me give you three categories. One category is where you have a mother, or we'll put it broader than that, the spouse, who is involved in terms of the complicity. They're actually a participant in terms of setting it up. One woman described for me a time where she was invited by her mother to go out and play baseball with her family, her brothers and her father and cousins. And she kept saying, "I don't want to play." And her mother kept saying, "No, go out and play. You need some exercise. Get off the porch, go play." Finally, after 10 minutes or so, she finally convinced the 13-year-old daughter to go out and play baseball. When she got out on the field, 3 or 4 minutes after being on the field, the mother started to her anger. "Take your blouse off. You're going to get it sweaty." And she said, "No, I don't want to take my blouse off." And the mother began to shame her. "What's your problem? You think your breasts are too big anyway to show people? You don't have anything there to show to begin with." And as she began to harangue and shame her, she eventually gave in to the pressure, took her blouse off. 2 days later, her father abused her for the first time. The same girl was having a dress made by her mother. And at one point, there needed to be a particular piece of work done on the dress. And though there were two female siblings in the other room, the mother called to the father, who was way up in the bedroom, to come downstairs. And when he came downstairs, he had him hold the dress up so that she could work on the, or so the mother could work on the dress. But rather than holding it up, which would have been just as natural for it to be held up from the outside with both hands, what he had him do is put his hands up the 13-year-old girl's dress in order to hold it to her body. And there's no other word for that than complicity. There's no other word for that but evil. And let me tell you, there are far more evil mothers and fathers in this world than we want to acknowledge. There are far, for whatever motivation, far more parents who are willing to literally enjoy and do harm to their children than any of us want to admit. I have no figures, but my bet is there are many in this room who are unwilling to face that you not only have a wicked father, a wicked mother, but you have even worse, an evil mother, an evil father, who at some level looks to your destruction. And that's true in terms of the first category, and that's betrayal. Second category is the parent who may not be part of the complicity and nevertheless, though, knows of the abuse and is unwilling to deal with it. The parent who, as in many cases, the mother who walks through the bedroom and sees the brother and sister in the bed and simply says, "You two get out of there," and never deals with it, never talks about it, never asks about it. One particular mother, and here, just forgive me. I don't have the maturity yet to know how to deal with things like this. I know who this woman is. I know what city she's in. I know her significant citywide Bible ministry. And let me tell you, at my worst moments, my thought is, my number one commitment in life is to ruin her. I would love to break confidentiality and just say, here's the woman. Let me put her before you. Because she has an incredible ministry in a particular city in this country. And she is reputed to be one of the finer, strongest, loving Christian women who many, many people go to get help, nurture, counsel, advice. When her daughter, who I work with, was 12 years of age, she was abused by a cousin. After the first abusive event, the mother would take the daughter over to this home. And when the daughter learned where the mother was taking her, she would plead and beg and weep to not be taken there. To the point where she literally get physically ill every single time she went to this home. Many times, she'd literally have to be dragged out of the car and often would be in the process of vomiting when she'd be taken into the home. Now, would you not stop and think that somebody might just even contemptuously ask, what's your problem? The mother never did it. When she later, 8 years after the abuse had stopped, told the mother about what had occurred, her mother said these words, I never, ever want to hear you defame your cousin in that way again. And if you ever so do so, I want you to know I will no longer have any contact with you again. I hate to say, that's more common again than any of us want to admit. Parents who, because of their own issues, would prefer to see you not so much pursue your damage, but are willing to allow you to be damaged because they don't want to deal with the potential loss of a marriage, potential loss of friendships, possible controversy or shame that might come to the family as a result of the abuse. Third part, in terms of betrayal, is where you have a parent who you can't tell. The parent may not have been involved in terms of the complicity. The parent may not even know of the abuse in any way, shape, or form. But because of the character of that parent, you could never have told that parent what was going on in terms of the abuse. Two broad categories. Category one, the parent is too fragile. The parent is too fragile to tell. You know that if you told your mom, she'd never recover. It'd be such a wound or such a blow to her soul that she'd never be able to handle life again. Well, are you going to tell a mother like that that you've been abused sexually? Well, of course not. Is that betrayal? Yes, it's a failure of character, even though it may not be involvement at all in the abusive event. But it's a failure of character that makes it near impossible to tell the parent that the pain or the struggle has gone on. Is that abandonment? Is that betrayal? Oh, yes. Or on the other side, where the parent's not so much fragile, but the parent's murderous. Where you know if you were to tell, you know your father would have gone out and killed the man. Well, of course you're not going to tell. If what you fear is your father's rage or violence is of a nature of a sort that you can't trust him to handle awful pain without becoming explosive. What's the consequences of that level of pain in terms of the betrayal? Very simply put, and I put it in generic terms simply because of time, you learn that intimacy cannot be trusted. You learn intimacy cannot be trusted. People are going to use you. If you open yourself up, what will the result be? Either abandonment or abuse. And as I come to knowing that intimacy won't work, the only way to do that and to live with that is to become a suspicious person. A suspicious person who doesn't trust anybody. And that can go anywhere from kind of genteel suspiciousness to outright paranoia. A certain strong level of, nobody's going to get to me. No one's going to have access to the deepest parts of my soul where you can do me damage again because I don't trust you at all. On the other side, and here we can begin to underline some of the effects of shame and contempt in the category of abuse. What are you not going to trust in your own soul? Somebody have a word? Your longings. See, your longings open the door to hungering for a relationship. If I hunger for a relationship, then what's going to happen? Yeah, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to get abused again. So ultimately, I don't trust you. But hear this well. Nobody can escape being made in the image of God. Nobody. And what's true about the image of God is it's like a very low, constant siren inside of you that says, you hunger for love, you hunger for impact. You can no more escape that than you can escape the face of God. But if I can't escape it or can't kill it finally, then what can I do with it? I can turn against it. Now go back to all the categories we talked about yesterday, and I'm going to do some shorthand. In other words, what will I do with the hunger of my soul with regard to you in terms of the relationship I want from you? What's the number one way to make sure I'm not exposed to you in terms of the hunger of my soul? And knowing full well that if I am exposed as naked before you, that I hunger for a relationship with you, what are you going to do to me? You're going to shame me by using me again. And therefore, what do I do with the hunger for relationship? As I pour, and you know the phrase, I pour contempt on the flames of my own passion. And contempt becomes a liquid or substance that douses the fire of your own passion, your own hunger, your own longings for more. Because you can't trust yourself. Because look what's happened every time you've gotten in a relationship before. You've been used again and again and again and again. So don't do it again. But something wars with inside of you. You want. You can't escape the fact you're made in the image of God. It wars inside of you and propels you toward people. And yet you can't move toward people because you're going to get shamed again. And therefore, the only way to make sure that I somehow keep the longings of my soul in chains is by the icy blast of contempt. Because as long as I'm putting myself down, then go ahead, use me. Fine. I'm a piece of dung anyway. What difference does it make? Go ahead. You want my body? Fine. Have fun. Or go ahead, use my body. Try. Get me in bed and then see what's going to happen. I'll make you pay. Self-contempt? Go ahead, use me. I don't care. Other-centered contempt? I'll find some way to strangle you. I'll make you pay for the damage that other men have done. And so that context of contempt is a way of partitioning my soul and making sure that the passion that's there never gets out of hand. Well, how does that do for relationships? Needless to say, those who've been betrayed have a very hard time developing anything like soul, spirit, or body oneness. And therefore marriages, therefore friendships, therefore all sorts of human contacts are just ruined, made a mockery of. Third category. And that's the category of ambivalence / confusion / craziness. What's the cause? Basically, again, I've already said it, but let me say it again. What's the cause of the ambivalence, the confusion, the craziness? I can put it in a very simple way. What I hate, I'm afraid to give up. Because what I feel is a level of pleasure, a level of enjoyment, a level of life that if I'm afraid that if I put aside, I'll have nothing in its place. Put it this way, a bad parent is always better than no parent at all. Bad abuse feels better than no involvement whatsoever. Don't you think it's true in terms of your own life? What is more painful for you? To be ignored and to have people be utterly indifferent towards you or to be hated? Which would you prefer? You might think you'd prefer the blandness of indifference, but only for a period of time because loneliness is far worse than conflict. Hate my guts. My preference would be you love me. But don't take me indifferently. Don't be apathetic to my material. Don't be apathetic to my soul. The Lord said that pretty much himself, didn't he? Would I, it's a frightening phrase, would I that you were hot or cold? But the fact is, you're lukewarm, and therefore I desire to spew you out of my mouth. To me, that's the most contemptuous sentence the Lord ever said. Full of, if you will, invective. Because passionlessness is far worse than hatred. Far worse than life itself. And what occurs with the abused individual is that they have a taste of life that is hard to give up. Whether it be through the process of relationship, whether it be through the process of sensual contact or even sexual contact. One woman described the event where she was abused. 70-year-old man invited her over to see the new rabbits that he had in his barn. She came from a family where she had never, in her recollection, at the age of 14, had ever been physically touched by either her mother or her father. She could not recall any time where a handshake, let alone even a hug, no physical contact in this very typical Christian family. She was invited over to look at the rabbits. And in a very short period of time, this man went through all four stages. He said, would you like to see my rabbits? I've shown no one. Took her up to the second floor of the barn and began to describe to her the normal eating and mating practices of a rabbit. From that point on, he asked her, would you like to hold a rabbit? Seated her at a particular bale of hay and had her sit with a rabbit in her lap. And he stood behind her and massaged her neck and back. And she remembered feeling terror. It was the first time, literally, she could recall ever being touched. But she also felt a level of excitement that she had never felt before. It felt good. As he began to touch her, after a few moments, he began to slip his hand down her blouse. And there he touched her breast for about 20 seconds. After about 20 seconds of frozen, terrifying, but nevertheless somewhat a rising taste of excitement, not so much pleasure. Again, I don't want to talk about a 14-year-old girl having adult sexual orgasmic pleasure and being touched by a 70-year-old man. But do you understand the concept well enough to say there was something inside of her that came alive in that time? After 20 seconds, she jumped up and ran away. As she was running away, he said, if you ever tell, I'll kill you. She never told a soul till she told me. And she described with untold pain her hatred for herself for having allowed that event to go on. As a quick aside, never try and tell a person that the abuse was not their fault, even though it never was. It doesn't work to say to the abused person, you were 14, what did you expect of yourself? You were 12, you were 8, you were 4. Some time ago, I worked with a woman who recalled in the middle of a counseling session the time in which she was raped for the first time at age 4 by her father. Afterwards, her father tenderly held her after the rape was finished. And she recalled with incredible contempt for her own soul the fact she felt comforted. How, after such a heinous event of being raped, could she allow herself to feel any level of connectedness to her father, let alone any level of tenderness and pleasure in his physical touch? That's the craziness of the human soul that comes from abuse. That's the utter ambivalence that I feel in knowing I'm being used, but not wanting to give it up, hating it, hating it with a passion that is simply unknown to man. This woman who described what had occurred when the man had his hand on her breast for 20 seconds said as adamantly as can be, if I'd only stopped it after 15 seconds, I could feel good about myself. And I said, what if you'd done it at 15? And she said, then after 10. And I said, after 10. 5. After 5. 2 seconds. At 2. I should never have gone up there to begin with. I should have known what was going to happen. It didn't work to say to her, you can't be that hard on yourself. What had to be done is to expose the function of contempt. Because the function of contempt is a way of somehow dissolving the craziness, somehow dissolving the ambivalence. If somehow I can see myself as absolutely vile and despicable, whorish, cheap, stained, damaged goods, whatever phrases you'd like to use, if somehow I can see myself in those categories, then I don't have to linger with the incredible damage that I feel in my soul and the hunger that I'm so afraid of. Contempt destroys hunger. And as long as hunger is viewed as the enemy, as long as hunger is viewed as the enemy, then I've got someone to blame. I've got something in my soul I can blame. And as long as I blame it, then I've left myself in control. Then I've left myself in a position where I'm not going to let you abuse me again. I'm not going to want anything from you again. I don't want anything from me again, ever. Contempt destroys the passion of the human soul so that the potential for reactivization of other abusive events are in fact minimized. But in fact, tragically, they're maximized because a dead soul is open to all sorts of abuse. Let me talk about the response now that we've talked about the damage. And though what I'm about to present, again, I somewhat embarrassedly would prefer several hours to do this, but don't have, please hear some of the basic concepts and I'll let your good minds germinate on it, and you'll see a whole lot more implications than I'll provide you. But broadly speaking, I have seen three particular styles with all sorts of variations. But these particular styles of relating, you know the concept well by now. These forms of relating to others seem to be the means of, hear the term, packaging shame and contempt. A means of finding a certain equilibrium so that I don't feel shame by use of contempt. Each one of these styles of relating has a practice of using contempt that's a bit different than the other. Three basic styles of relating. I have called these the good girl, the tough girl, and the party girl. Let me describe each very briefly. The good girl. Internally, the good girl is basically unwilling to do anything that brings to the surface feelings that are viewed as impolite, as somehow not civil, somehow not proper. She's a good girl. The idea of antiseptic feelings. She doesn't feel anger. She doesn't feel ambivalence. She doesn't feel rage. She doesn't feel lust. She doesn't feel much of anything. Whatever she feels is it's packaged rather carefully. Therefore, externally, she's just nice. She's busy. She's helpful. She's a rescuer. She takes care of others. She hates conflict with a passion. That's about the only passion in her life, is that she hates conflict. And therefore, she continually allows herself to be reabused. When she feels abused, just like any human being, if I walk up to you after the lecture and pound you in the face, you can't but help feel pain. That's the way God made you. But the good girl, when she feels pain, feels, you know the next phrase? Selfish for feeling pain. If I hit a good girl, she'd apologize to me for being in my way. She's there to please people. She's there to take care of people. She's not there to engage her soul in relationship with others. The good girl keeps her soul under control by what form of contempt? It should be rather clear already. By self-contempt. She's constantly putting herself down. You're not bright enough. You're not competent enough. You weren't busy enough. You didn't do it well enough. And so she will be a very driven woman to do what? To make sure you're happy. But the only way she can take care of her pain internally is by putting herself in a position of feeling constant guilt. Guilt is just another word for sinful contempt. She feels hurt. She feels selfish. She handles her selfishness by pouring contempt on herself, and then she gets busy and gets responsible and does twice the amount of work she would have done before, and therefore opens herself from credible burnout. But the burnout is handled by what? More work. The good girl seriously hates her own soul and views it as nothing other than immature, childish, selfish, inadequate, incomplete. That's a bit different, however, from the second category, and that's the tough girl. Internally, she does not view her longings and her pain as childish or selfish, but she views it as a pain in the neck. She views her pain or longings as something to be overcome. Something to be managed. Something to be disciplined. Is this woman likely to feel much pain? Not much at all. Do you recall in the IBC seminar, one particular time I talk about style of relating, and I talk about a woman who wore the gray flannel power suit, the gold jewelry, the silk blouse, crossed legs with the kid glove, whatever, folder, cross pen, precise, who wanted to know about my educational pedigree. She was a tough girl, trial lawyer, competent woman, with a real edge about her, a chip on her shoulder that basically said, don't even bother. Don't even bother trying to get close. Because when you do, let me tell you, I will hang you. I will make you pay. And therefore, unlike the good girl who's constantly working to make sure that people are pleased, the tough girl at some level is constantly saying, I hope you know I'm dangerous. I hope you know I'm strong. I'm capable. I'm intimidating. Get me into a fight and you don't know what's going to happen. Now, again, do you see where I'm going? What's her style of contempt? Self-contempt? Not real likely. She's usually an expert at other-centered contempt. She's cynical. She's sarcastic. Often very funny, but always in a demeaning way toward others. Now, will there under the surface, please hear this well, will there under the surface be rampaging self-contempt? Of course, but you're not likely to see it. Let me go back to the good girl now. What's going to be underneath the surface of the good girl? Rampaging, other-centered contempt. Let me tell you, I have been... What do you do to a deer after you've caught it and killed it and you want to eat it? What's the term? Yeah, dressing, is it dressing or gutting it or vitiated or whatever? The point is, I've been hung out to dry by more good girls than any tough girl in the world. Because when a good girl starts to face what's underneath the surface, she begins to see the pulsating rage that she feels toward others. So please don't hear that the good girl doesn't have other-centered contempt. Generally speaking, it's just under her consciousness or underneath her breath. Just as with the tough girl, does she struggle with self-centered contempt? Of course. Sometimes a self-contemptuous tough girl can be as vicious as you could imagine toward herself for failure at her task. Third category. The party girl. Now, I need to define this because several people have helped me think this through a bit more, and I really think there are almost two different kinds of party girl. One is what I want to call the kind of the party girl proper, meaning literally the bar hopper, the woman who's promiscuous, and the woman who's just a good time, loose, free. But there's another form of party girl, and that is just what might be called the funny girl. just a good time. She's not so much immoral, though she could easily be, but she's just the life of the party, the jokester, the comedian, the life of the party, the social coordinator. So in either case, the dynamics, I think, are somewhat similar. Internally, what she's saying is, I know there's pain, but I know there's a way out, and it's through superficial pleasure. There's a way out, and it's through superficial pleasure. Because loyalty terrifies me. Don't ever get me nailed down. This is the woman who'll date a man until he gets too close. Bingo! She's out of there. She'll find some way to sabotage the relationship. And then she'll go to another relationship and be in that for 6 weeks or 6 months, and then bingo, sabotage. Many, many times what I've experienced with the party girl is this. Come forward, but you don't know when the fist is going to hit you. And the fist can be just as tough as the tough girl, and the open hand can be as inviting as the good girl. In other words, what kind of contempt is the party girl best at? Basically, she's ambicontemptuous. She can use either hand equally well. And that contempt is a very, very crazy contempt, because at one moment she's mocking herself and the next moment she's mocking you. At one moment, she's inviting you into a relationship. At the next moment, she's swinging you from a tree. And you still don't know when it's going to happen. You don't know when the contempt is going to rage against herself or rage against you. Whereas with the tough girl, you kind of know generally what's going to happen. And with the good girl, you kind of know what's going to happen. But do you hear theoretically we're all are alike? All are unwilling to be in a position where they experience the shame of abandonment and abuse. The experience of somehow I've wanted and I've moved forward to receive. And as I've grasped for that which my soul hungers for, you've either given me a snake rather than a loaf of bread, or you've pulled away the bread so that in fact I'm empty. Shame arises for the abused person in that they hungered for that which then became soul distorting and damaging. They trusted, if you will, in a false god that would satisfy and then toppled. And as anyone who trusts in a false god and has that god topple, they will experience shame. And the way to handle shame is to live with the blanket of contempt that is either directed toward you or directed toward me, because in so doing, I extinguish the flames of whatever passion, whatever hunger there exists, that might put me in a position where I'm harmed again and shamed again. And therefore, I will remain free of damage to the degree I kill my own soul. The backlash is that as I kill my own soul, I do even greater damage to myself than what the abuser did originally. And that's frightening for the abused person to face. That I've damaged my own soul in ways that do not make light, that do not minimize for a moment the damage that was originally done. But nevertheless, I have victimized my own soul. Not only that, but because I've been in the process of victimizing myself, there's no way in the world that I have escaped victimizing you. To whatever degree you abuse your own soul with contempt, you're assuredly abusing others as well. And therefore, those who've been abused must face the fact that in many cases, they've done equal damage to others. Equal, if not worse, damage to others. The field today is split between what I want to call the fundamentalists on the left and the fundamentalists on the right. The fundamentalists on the left want to scream victimization and that alone. And I grant you, a woman or man who's been abused has been victimized and damaged. That's why we spent so much time in underlining it. And if there's any implication, not again, hear my phrase, I hope as well as you hear anything, the abused individual has nothing to repent of with regard to the abusive events. It is not their fault. But what the abused individual is called to face is the damage that has been done to their own soul and the damage they've done to others. And what has to be repented of is not the pleasure, not the events, but the hatred of their own soul and therefore the hatred of others that is that has not given them the entitlement to love in the way that they were gifted to do so. If there's going to be change for the abused individual, it will come only on the basis of deep repentance. Of what? Of their style of relating that has been formed out of different particles of contempt that are there in order to destroy their soul because it's so dangerous. And by commitment to boldly loving, sacrificially, boldly, strongly, not effeminately, which just puts yourself back into more harm, but boldly moving out into the lives of others to love them in the way that God so designed. I wish we had another hour to take that last phrase apart. What does it mean to boldly love the abuser? Sometimes I literally think it might mean taking a gun out and killing them. I have a woman whom I'm working with by phone who has been abused by her father years and years after the childhood events. The last time she was raped by him was age 32. And I told her the next time he attempts to break into the house that she is to warn him of the prospect of what will occur if he continues to try and break the door down. And if he comes through the door, she is to take her stand as she has been taught at a particular firearms locale and to pull the trigger and to shoot him, and preferably to shoot him in the leg, because again, her desire is not to kill him, but to wound him, to protect herself, and in fact, to protect him from his own damaging soul. And if in consequence she kills him, I think it's justifiable. And in fact, if you think it's a strange phrase, loving homicide. At times, I think it's loving to go to the abuser and simply deal with your own sin toward him, as well as to open the door to dealing with his sin toward you. I want to paint the gambit from the one end to the other and simply say, I can't tell you what it means unless I work with you and think it through with you and you're in community with others, thinking it through. What does it mean to boldly love the abuser? There are no easy answers. Sometimes it means to never have contact with them again until there's repentance. Sometimes it means continuing contact even when there's no repentance. How can I make sense of both concepts in 10 hours, let alone another 2 minutes? The point is, it requires a redeemed heart that longs for restoration, that's willing to boldly give for the purpose of seeing God's will done in every human being's life that you have the opportunity to touch for his purposes. And with that, I believe there will be the development of wisdom to know when to do this, when to do that, how to do this, how not to do that. I have lots of problems with books that say that you must confront the abuser. But many of the people I work with, I do believe, need to confront the abuser. But only after they've dealt with what? Facing the damage and dealing with repentance of a style of relating that is incompatible with the purposes of God. And then boldly loved those whom they're in relationship with so that they've developed, if you will, a track record of deep movement toward God and others that will then enable them to be able to move toward the abuser in a way that, in fact, is potentially restorative. I've got another minute before the tape ends, so if you have a question, ask quickly. It'll be on the tape. If not, then we'll take another 10 minutes to answer questions. Tomorrow, when we come back, we'll deal with the issue of how to deal with shame and contempt. Again, in broad categories, but also more specifically in the category of sexual abuse. Yes, ma'am.
Can they, can things fall into the three categories?
can people fall into three, or can women fall into those three categories? The answer is yeah. Any type system has its great liabilities in that at one level, everybody falls into all three. But I think what I've found is people seem to have symptomatic and idiosyncratic patterns. You tend to be more of a tough girl in most situations, though there are times where you're a good girl as well as a party girl. Generally, you'll have one preferred mode, even though different situations, different people, different issues will often shape and shift those about.
Do they go through processes?
Sure, absolutely. Can there be a process where 18 to 24, you're a party girl, and then you get married and you're a tough girl until you have kids and then you're kind of a good girl? Oh yeah, I think there are developmental stages. Again, you're talking about all sorts of fun things that once you get the basic pattern down, then you can start shifting and changing according to your own experience and your own work with others. I think it's important to say that nobody is just one pattern and that alone, nor are you only one pattern during your life, your whole life. It can shift and be very variable. Yes, ma'am, in the back. Huh. The question is, are the three related to the three last night? How about if we say cousins? I think it's very possible to be a good girl who's also a happy Pharisee. I think it's possible to be a tough girl who's a happy Pharisee. I think it's possible to be a party girl who's a happy Pharisee. Depending on what? Is your world working? As a tough girl, is it working for you? As a party girl, is it working for you? But would I likely say that more cynical, more party girls are more, you know, are there many good girls who are cynical? Not that often. So I think there's some relationship, but I wouldn't want to get too nice and boxy about it. Yes, ma'am.
Two questions. First of all, as far as putting the blame where it belongs, can that statement be made if it's couched in the recognition that, you know, expressed to the person, to the counselee, that they may not understand or be able to really grasp this concept yet, but that this is something you want them to begin to hear?
Yes, now let me answer that real quickly by saying that the question is, can you at least assuage part of the problem by saying that it's not your fault that you were abused? Yes, yeah, say it all you want, just know it won't help. Or if it helps, it only takes away, if it's 10 layers of contempt, it takes away one. Which again, if one quick wipe with water will take away one, and it's going to take 9 layers, it's going to take sandpaper to get the other 9, well, wash it away with one layer of water, that's great. I'm all for it. Don't think that it works. That's my only point.
Okay.